Hey everyone, this is Pastor Brian Ross from Grand Rapids, Michigan, pastor of Grace Life Bible Church. And I wanted to just do a quick video about a topic that I've been getting some questions on. A number of weeks ago, a couple videos were created, one using YouTube, it was a longer video, and a second one on Facebook, which was a shorter advertisement for the longer video, related to the words end sample and example. And this generated some discussion on Facebook and social media, and I've had some people asking me questions about that conversation. And so I wanted to create a video dealing with that topic this evening. I've been actually intending and meaning to do this for a number of weeks, and I just haven't had opportunity. And when I have had opportunity, I've had technical problems, and things haven't gone the way that I've wanted them to. But let me start out by saying, I have here King James Bible, and I have zero problem whatsoever with the word end sample. I have zero problem with that word. It's a perfectly fine word. I don't think it should be changed. I think it is should it remain as it stands in the text. What I have a problem with, though, is when people say things about some of these words that I can't find any documentation for, that I can't find any proof of. And that's where I start to want to look into things and want to investigate, are the things that are being said about certain words, like in sample, actually true? Or are they, or what's going on? And in doing so, I've talked about this quite at length in my book, The King James Bible in America, an Orthographic, Historical, and Textual Investigation, where I looked into some of these things at quite an in-depth level. And even since I published that book in September of last year, so nearly a year ago now, I've looked at some more things and more additional things related to this. So some folks, myself included, what was causing concern is what was being said about end sample. So again, let me be clear. I don't think end sample should be changed to example. I think it's a perfectly fine word, but I think that we need to understand the word accurately and appropriately and understand it for what it actually is. And this is where some people, I think, are really struggling with some of these matters. So in the video, the short video that was recorded to advertise the longer video, this is what was said. The creator of that video said, it's a word study on ensample and example, because there's a difference between ensample and example. If you listen to certain other people who think they got to go to the Greek or their Oxford English dictionary, then they're going to tell you the wrong definitions. So according to this individual, the dictionary is going to give you the wrong definition of the word ensample and example. He goes on to say, I use my King James Bible, stayed with the context, and I derived my own definitions for the words. So this is what is causing concern. It causes me concern, and it's caused others concern. The idea that somebody can come up with their own definitions, their own meanings of words based upon a contextual reading of the King James Bible. So in the longer video, this is how the word ensample was defined, and this is a quote with timestamps, etc., from the longer video. Here's what was said. So, what is an ensample? By looking at the context of my King James Bible, which is the 1769 edition of the 1611 Pure Cambridge text, no spelling changes need to be made, no word changes need to be made, leave it alone, don't correct it, don't update it. So I'm going to leave that alone right now. I'm not going to talk about the Pure Cambridge position, although that probably should be discussed in some detail so people understand actually what the Pure Cambridge position is, but that's a topic possibly for another video. Let the book define the word in the book. It will do it if you let it. And so after examining, and there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, there are 6 words that the word ensample or ensample occurs in your King James Bible, and are to derive the word usage of ensample or ensamples in the text. The word is always referring to and only refers to the character or the behavior or the characteristics of a man as a pattern, And that pattern is to a group of individuals, or can also, in some cases, be to an individual group. So like the whole body of Christ, but it's one body. So it would be an individual group. Or it can be individuals in a group. Okay, here's the thing about ensample. It's always dealing with a person's characteristics, or that person can be a pattern. It never has to do with the situation, occurrence, process, or an event. It is always the characteristic of a person. That's what ensample means. So that's the definition that this person gave, deriving their own definition from the text. And so it only has to ever do with a person's characteristics, or that person as a pattern, and it never deals with, according to this individual, a situation, occurrence, process, or an event. So this is the way this word is being defined by this person, based upon the context of the King James Bible alone. So here's my problem with that. The person that said this isn't the only person I've ever heard say this. But the problem is that everybody that says this is coming up with their own definition. They are coming or arriving or deriving different definitions or meanings for these words when they all say or claim that they're using the same process. So let me take you over here and let's look at this. So I have some examples of people who are claiming to use the same methodology, i.e. they're claiming to be defining these words based upon the context of the word in the King James Bible alone, yet they are coming to and arriving at wildly different definitions than other people who are claiming to use the same methodology. So let's look at the first example here. The first example comes from Matthew, however you pronounce his last name, or Bible Protector. This is the articulator of the Pure Cambridge position, and he wrote a book called Glistering Truths. So that's this book right here. Distinctions in Bible Words, Glistering Truths. Now look at what it says. That every jot and tittle in our pure English Bible is necessary for giving the exact sense. So he is advocating a position, Bible Protector is advocating a position that if even one letter, if even one thing is off, even a little bit, then a given edition of the King James is not capable of conveying the exact sense. So that's what he's arguing in his book, Glistering Truths. Now, here's how he finds ensample. An ensample is one that can be internalized through specific personal knowledge of the object looked at. Now, that is directly contradictory to what this person says when he said that it never has to do with a situation, occurrence, process, or an event. It is always the characteristic of a person. So here we have two different King James advocates that are claiming to be defining the word based upon the context of the King James Bible alone, yet they can't agree about what the meaning of the word is. And then here's his definition of example. An example is an outward sample. So those are those definitions. Then we go to another example, Kyle Stevens. Kyle Stevens is the author of this book right here, The Certainty of the Words, and the subtitle is How the King James Bible Resolves the Ambiguity of the Original Languages. So Kyle Stevens is going to have yet another set of examples or definitions for these words, and he's claiming also to derive these from the King James text alone, and not using any dictionaries, not using any study helps, not using any aids. Yet his definitions are going to be different from Bible Protector's and from the video in question that we're discussing here. So he says examples in Scripture are loosely fitted lessons, warnings, and applications. They cannot be copied or emulated precisely to certain boundaries or constraints of circumstance. Ensamples are to be followed as precisely and exactly as possible. They are literally the samples of how we should live, respond, and act. So Kyle Stevens' definition is different from Bible Protector, who's different from the video in question, yet all of them are claiming to have derived these definitions from the King James Bible alone. So then there's also folks who want to maintain or do maintain and argue. I've heard at least three different presentations of this that the words don't mean the same thing based upon the prefix en on nSample and ex on example. And so it's argued that, well, en is an inward thing, like entrance, like I enter a building, whereas example is an outward thing, like exit, like I'm exiting, that kind of thought process. And even in these presentations, there's not agreement on what the meanings of the words are. So my point is if the King James Bible, if we are to take an archaic word like ensample and we are to simply define it by the context because of the King James built-in dictionary, as Gail Ripplinger argues for in this book, The Language of the King James Bible, then why is everybody coming up with different definitions? Why are the definitions not the same? All right. So let's just go back and look at a few other things. So I went back in my book and I did research and I went all the way back to 1658. Now let me explain. I did this research looking into this because I was perplexed about listening to Bible teachers who I respect and preach with, who are saying these words mean certain things, and I can't find evidence that what they're telling me was true. And so I set out to investigate this. In 1658, Edward Phillips did a dictionary called The New World of Words. So this is from 1658, so within 50 years of the translation of the King James. And notice how it defines ensample. It says old world, an example, model, or pattern. So it's defining ensample with the word example. So it's saying that an ensample is an old way of saying example. From 1721, we have Noah Bailey's A Universal Entomological Dictionary from 1721 that defines ensample as a pattern, as an example or a pattern. So again, the words here are being used interchangeably. These old dictionaries are saying that an ensample is an old world way of saying example, but that they mean the same thing. They're just differently spelled words that are conveying the exact same meaning. That's what these are telling us. Okay. Then if we look at, so I have the interlinear pulled up here for, this is for, set 1 Corinthians chapter 10. Verse 11, and if we come down here and we look at this, whoops, I think I went too far. Here it is. We see ensample. So here's the King James text in English, ensamples, and here's the Greek word. So we're going to click on that, and we're going to load this interlinear, and we can see every time that the word typos occurs in the text. So here we have 1 Corinthians 6:10. These things were written for our examples. A few verses later in 1 Corinthians 10:11, now all these things happen unto them for ensamples. So within the same context, the King James translators render the word once as example and once as ensample. Now look, these are textual facts. So whatever you're going to say about this matter, you have to take into account the textual facts of the case that actually exists. You cannot just sweep this under the rug and pretend like this isn't the situation. We have to deal with the facts on the ground as they actually are. And the facts on the ground as they actually are is that, number one, old dictionaries say that the two words, that ensample is an old world way of saying example, that they have the same meaning. And then we come over here and we look and we see that the same word is translated example, ensample, ensample, 1 Thessalonians 1:7, and sample, 2 Thessalonians 3:9, and sample, 1 Timothy 4:12, example. Down here in Titus 2, it's pattern. So the same word is translated both ways. We can come over here to 2 Peter, and I'm looking at the interlinear for 2 Peter chapter 2, verse 6, and we can find here, again, here's the King James text in English, them as an ensample. And we can click on this and we can load up again the lexicon information here. And this is just reporting the facts of the case here, folks. And look at what we encounter. So John 3, example. Hebrews 4, example. Hebrews 8:5, example. Hebrews 9:23 pattern. And every time, oh, example, oh, look at this, end sample. So both of the Greek words that are associated with both end sample and example, both of them are variously rendered by the King James translators as both end sample and example. So what are we to make of this? Are we to agree? And I ask questions that have still not been answered regarding this. But are we to agree with what Kyle Stevens says in The Certainty of the Words? Notice what he says about this. So I just showed you the textual facts, okay? So end sample and example are coming from the same Greek word, and notice what Kyle Stevens says about this. He says, quote, "Let us face facts. Either there is a stumbling in the translation of the King James, or else Greek scholars missed something that was not missed in the AV. The two languages set forth different revelation of knowledge that is not mutually consistent." Now, the reason he's saying that is because he's defined end sample and example differently. So watch what he says. What is revealed in the two languages conflicts. The Greek is the final authority and the AV is pernicious, or else the AV reveals, manifests, and instructs beyond the Greek. So what he's saying there is that there is some sort of special second inspiration that occurred when the translators are translating that is revealing beyond what the preserved Greek text of the Textus Receptus says. Now, that might be okay for an Acts 2 Baptist like Kyle Stevens to say something like that, but those of us who are King James advocates who are also mid-Acts Pauline dispensationalists, we cannot embrace this. So old dictionaries say they mean the same thing. The King James, the textual facts are that the same two Greek words are rendered using both English words. Okay. Let's look at the preface to the King James Bible. So this is in the translators to the preface. And notice what they say here in this section. "Another thing we think good to admonish thee of, gentle reader, that we have not tied ourselves to a uniformity of phrasing or to an identity of words as some peradventure would wish we had done." So what are they telling you there? They're telling you that they are going to use a variety of English words to say the same thing. So as long as a particular English word captured the meaning of a given Hebrew or Greek word, they were not going to lock themselves into a principle of rigidity and how to render that word into English. This is what they're saying right here. And they're cognizant and aware of the fact that some people aren't going to like this, because they observe that some learned men somewhere have set as an exact, as they have been as exact as they could that way, truly that we might not vary from the sense of that which we had translated before. If the word signified the same in both places, for there be words that be not the same sense everywhere, we were especially careful and made a conscience according to our duty. But that we should express, notice, the same notion in the same particular word, as for example, if we translate the Hebrew or Greek word once by purpose, never to call it intent. So what are they telling you? They're telling you that they would take the same Greek word, and as long as there was no difference in the sense of what it meant given a particular context, they felt themselves completely free to say purpose one time and intent somewhere else. If one were journeying, never traveling. If one were think, never suppose. If one were pain, never ache. If one were joy, never gladness. So what are they telling you? They're telling you that as long as a word conveyed the sense and the meaning of the Greek or the Hebrew, they were not locking themselves into a principle of rigidity. They were going to use synonyms, and that they were not locking themselves into a uniformity of phrasing or to an identity of words. So that's the King James translators telling us, the reader, what they did. All right. So what evidence do we have now? We have a lot of different lines of evidence. We have the testimony of old dictionaries. We have the textual facts. We have the statement and the testimony of the translators themselves. And then we come to something like the Noah Webster's American Dictionary of the English Language from 1828. And this is what we find for ensample. So we're talking about the verb form of this, not the noun. But notice what it says. To exemplify, to show by example, this word is seldom used either as a noun or a verb. See example. So what Noah Webster is telling you is that ensample has fallen out of usage and it has been replaced now with example, but the words mean the same thing. So if I click on example and I come over here, I see eight different definitions of the word example, which can mean the same thing as ensample. And then I have different meanings. Number two, a pattern in morals or manners. Number three, a precedent of a former instance. Number four, precedent of former instance in a bad sense. Number two is a pattern in morals, a copy or model, that which is proposed or is proper to be imitated. So it could be a good thing, it could be a bad thing. And what happened in the conversation that happened in Facebook is what started out as a conversation stating here that the definitions were derived and that the word only means one thing and not the other thing. Then the conversation shifted to, I can see that the dictionary, that the words can mean the same thing, but that the context of the King James Bible is determining which one of these eight definitions of ensample and example are being used. Folks, that is a totally different thing than saying I'm deriving these from my own study and the dictionary is wrong and is going to tell you wrong information. And then we have the Oxford English Dictionary entry. And we can see here that this is coming into English from Old French, okay, from Anglo-Norman. When the French Normans invaded England in 1066, they brought their language with them to the island. This mixed with Saxon, and this mixed with Anglo-Saxon, and it became Anglo-Norman, and they brought this word with them when they came during the invasion. Now notice what it said. It says that ensample is archaic, and it says that it equals example in various senses. And then it says that it's anachronistic and that its use is reminiscent in passages in which the word occurs in the New Testament. So literally the only thing that is keeping the word ensample in any kind of usage commonly, according to this dictionary at least, is the fact that it's in the Bible. Because it's been replaced now by example, but it means the same thing. And then we can come over here and we can go even further. So if this word is coming out of Anglo-Norman, we can go to the Middle English Dictionary. And Middle English is that time period from 1066 in the Norman conquest of Britain through till about the early 1500s and roughly the time of William Tyndale when you start entering into the modern English period. But if you go back here and look at this and sample, so let's load this up. We can see that ensample is a noun, and we can see that it's an instance typical of a class, an illustration of a general truth. We can click on the usages, and we can say, oh, look at this. This is used in the Wycliffe Bible from the late 1380s. So John Wycliffe is using this word all through his translation from the 1380s. So when he's doing that, he is using an already established English word to state in Middle English. He, in this case, is translating from the Latin Vulgate. But the point is that there are over 300 years of English language usage evidence to suggest that ensample is another way of saying example. Now, there's so much information here, we don't even have time to get into it. But we can see that. So let's come back over here and look at the tables that I created. So Here we have the two different words that I showed you for end sample and example. So here we have end samples. We have end sample and samples. And now let's look at this. So in this column, we have Wycliffe. Notice he uses figure. He uses form. And then notice end sample, end sample, end sample, end sample. Then down here where we have occurrences of example in the King James, end sample, done in a figure, end sample, end sample, end sample, end sample, end sample. Is Wycliffe using a word that's talking about a pattern, a figure, an example? He is. Look at Tyndale. Look at Tyndale. Same thing. William Tyndale. And sample, and sample, and sample. Aha. Spelling variant. In sample. Literally I-N. More of a phonetic spelling. Are we to say now that this is a wholly different word? Same thing here. In sample. And sample. And sample. He never uses example one time. It's always end sample. Why? Because that was the way the word was spelled. That was the way that the word was used back then during that time. Okay? So let's look at the next one. Look at Coverdale. We see one occurrence of example in Coverdale in 1 Thessalonians 1:7. Every other occurrence is end sample. Same with the Matthew's Bible of 1537, which I started talking about this morning. All end sample across the board. The Great Bible, every time it's occurring, it's some form of end sample. It's not until we get to the Geneva Bible that we start to see an increase in the occurrences of example. Now that's what that's telling you is that there is a change that's occurring in the way to spell this word. Okay? There's a change that's occurring in the way to spell this word. These words don't mean wholly different things. There's a change going on in the English language that is happening. And then we can go to the bishops and which was the base text for the King James according to rule number one. And we can see and sample, example, example, example. Notice, and then the Reams also is going to talk about example and never talks about end sample. I just included that for historical purposes. And then we have the King James, and we have all these occurrences of end sample and end sample, and then we have example. So what do we have? We have dictionary evidence. We have the translators themselves. We have the textual facts of the translation. We have the historical evidence in the translational data of the English Bible leading up to the King James, all right? And all of this points to the fact that these two words mean the same thing. One of them, the difference in spelling is related to how they're coming into English. So look down here. Latin, French, Anglo-Saxon, Anglo-Norman is a combination of French and Anglo-Saxon, Middle English equals Middle English and sample. Then later on, you have a different route, Latin, straight into French, straight into modern English, and then you have this prefix. So the EN, the ENS here, by the way, if there's really a prefix argument to be made here, it would be ENS, not EN, because the common is ample here on both of them. But anyway, the reason these words are spelled differently is because of the route in which they made it into English. So I've been going on here now for I don't know how long. I don't have a timer on this thing to show that because people are using the Bible and they are saying things like I'm deriving my own definitions. Some people think that I'm engaging here in a strife of words, which you're free to believe that if you want, but what I'm engaging in here is a historical investigation into what these words actually meant. So when the King James translators sit down between 1604 and 1611 to translate the King James Bible, they are using already established words in English of specific meaning to render the text into English. All right? So I'm going to read from Gail Ripplinger's The Language of the King James Bible here, discovering its hidden built-in dictionary. And this is what she says. The King James is a looking glass back. So on page, what page is this? This is page 5. The King James is a looking glass looking back at 1,000 years of the history of our culture's thinking and beliefs. The Webster's and Oxford dictionaries match the King James definitions exactly because the King James preceded them. God created the meaning of the words in the Bible itself. People read the Bible and picked up those meanings. The dictionaries merely reflect the culture. So what Gail Ripplinger is saying there is that the King James Bible preceded the Webster's 1828 Dictionary, the Oxford English Dictionary, and that the Bible defined what these English words meant, and that the King and that these dictionaries were just reflecting that. Folks, you need to think about what that's saying, and think critically about what that's saying. I've already showed you here tons of data about the history of translation and how this was done. When they pick and sample here in 1 Thessalonians 1:7, and they say and sample and not example, they're not meaning to say something wholly different. They're just using that word of 300-year established meaning and precedent to say what is said in English. So the King James isn't defining this word. The King James is using a word of long-standing meaning and definition. That's what a translation is. A translation is the taking out of one language and rendering into another, a receptor language, what that donor language says. This is what the King James translators did, and they used already established words in the English lexicon. And they did not, according to the preface, as I already showed you here, they did not lock themselves in to uniformity of phrasing or an identity of words. So let me try to wrap it up with this. The idea, yes, in time, it's true. The King James came before the Oxford English Dictionary and the Webster's Dictionary. But the King James did not didn't define those words. The translators didn't define those words. They were using words that already had specific meanings in English to state in English what the text said in Hebrew and Greek. This is misleading, what Gail Ripplinger is saying here, and it misunderstands what a translation actually is and how a translation is actually done. And I'll say this. I am extremely uncomfortable with the idea that words can take on specific meanings, apart from what they can historically be demonstrated to have meant simply because they are in a King James Bible. This is dangerous. This is subjective. This is bordering on possibly private interpretation, because I've already showed you at least three examples of people who are claiming to be using the exact same methodology, yet they are all arriving at wildly different definitions of the words. So I think we have to be careful about this. Let me also clarify. The Bible is its own best commentary and definer of words and phrases. That's a Bible thing. That's not a uniquely King James thing. That's something that God put in the Bible when he inspired it and would apply to any proper translation of the preserved text, not just the King James Bible. And it was never the intention of the translators to make the King James Bible their purpose in doing it was not to create a dictionary. To the extent that the Bible defines its own words and phrases is to the extent of God's work and revelation and inspiration that is a Bible thing, not a uniquely English thing in a King James Bible. So if you take the preserved text and you translate it into languages, you're going to find that if it's done appropriately and correctly using a formal equivalency method, that the Bible is going to do that in any language, because that's what the Bible does and that's the way God inspired it. So those are some of my thoughts. I have a lot more that I've gotten some questions on, and maybe from time to time here I'll come on and I'll say a few more things addressing this particular topic. But I'm fine with ensample. I'm not trying to change it. But let's be clear. If certain printings of a King James Bible do that, I also am not willing to say that those are manifest corruptions. And the reason for that is these types of spelling changes, this type of standardization of spelling, was already happening in America within 20 years of the founding of this nation and our establishing independence from Great Britain. When American publishers began to print the text, they began to Americanize the spelling. This is a point that is demonstrated in the King James Bible in America. And if we're going to say that those people had corrupted Bibles, we are reading our current textual debate and the things that are going on right now in the 20th and 21st century back upon previous generations of believers who didn't know anything about this topic. This wasn't even a debate for them, for most of them, because they clung to the Common English Bible, their King James Bible. Codex Sinaiticus had not even been discovered yet, and it was only way, way up in ivory towers that people had any idea about anything related to what would ultimately become the so-called science of textual criticism. So I'm not prepared to read what's going on today back upon bygone generations of believers and hold them to a standard that they never even thought that was an issue. I have found no evidence of that. So those are my thoughts. I'm sure some of you aren't going to like it. I'm sure, you know, but listen, I'm a King James Bible believer. I don't correct my King James Bible. I believe it's the Word of God, and I believe it's the Word of God in English for English speaking people. I think it's without error. I don't think it reports any information about God, who God is, his nature, his character, his fundamental dealings with mankind, his dispensational truth, or anything that's false, that's wrong, that's inaccurate. What I'm advocating for is a thorough, accurate understanding of our Bible in English that isn't too extreme and saying things that doesn't need to be said. So, with all that said, thanks for watching. See you next time.